It is time for Arthur Schwartz, the Food Maven. Arthur joins us on a Monday morning at this time. What do we talk about? We talk about food. Good morning, Arthur.
Good morning. I'm on a pork kick here. And I actually overbought, meaning I saw some great-looking chops at the butcher, and then I didn't get a chance to cook them, so they ended up in the freezer. Now, you know how sometimes the universe just sort of tells you what to do? So I'm sitting on the, I'm laying on the physical therapy table, getting my physical therapy from a therapist who, of course, I've become very friendly with after 2 years of laying on his table. And he's a cook. He cooks for his wife and kid, and he's a big he likes to say he's a carnivore. He's the one who encouraged me to go on this ketogenic diet of mainly fat and protein. So I'm laying on the table, and I'm saying, I have to his name is Jeff. I said, Jeff, I have these two pork chops in the freezer. What do you think I should do with them? And he says, that's funny. I have two pork chops in the freezer. What do you think I should do with mine? I come home, and I called my friend, Suzanne. And I said, Suzanne, what would you do with two pork chops? She says, I'm a vegan now. I said, I know you're a vegan, but for 70 years, you weren't. And you cooked. And you're from the South, so I know you know how to cook pork chops. Anyway, the problem with pork chops, as everybody knows, is they can be really dry and horrible.
Yeah.
And I never order one in a restaurant because it's invariably dry and horrible. But I do know how to cook them at home. And I know how to pick the pork. So in the end, Suzanne said, oh, well, Julia Child has this pork rub in the first volume of Mastering the Art of French Cooking. And I'm sure it's online. And the recipe, which is hardly a recipe. Well, it is a recipe. It's a formula for this rub is online. The version that I looked at was by Julia Moskin, who is a food writer for the New York Times. But then I have the volume one, you know, French cooking. So I looked it up in the book, and I love that Julia calls it a marinade sèche, meaning a dry marinade, because, of course, nobody in 1963, I think this book was first published, used the word rub. Well, I guess maybe in Texas. And other places in the Southwest, they did rubs. I watched, by the way, Marshall, do you ever watch what I always call the barbecue station? I don't even know what station it is, but the one that shows all the Kingsford barbecue cook-offs.
Yeah,
I like that.
It's not the Food Network. It's its companion one. I forget what it's called. But yeah, I love watching those barbecue things. Yeah, I watch them all the time.
I actually prefer watching these guys cook meat on a barbecue than most of the kitchen programs that they have. I'm hooked. First of all, they're all fat. Well, they're all very skinny or very fat, and nobody's that good-looking. So it's totally not intimidating visuals. But no, the thing that bothers me about all these barbecue chefs is that, or I should say pitmasters, to use the actual term for them, they all put garlic powder in their rub.
You're right.
Or things that I would never cook with.
I hate garlic powder.
I hate garlic powder, too. I told you, I mentioned this a zillion times, but there used to be, when I lived in Midtown Manhattan on 42nd and 2nd Avenue, there was a pizzeria that opened on 2nd Avenue and 43rd Street on the corner. It was owned by a bunch of stewardesses. I don't know what that was all about, but they used garlic powder in that pizzeria, and I literally had to cross the street because the ventilation from the pizzeria spilled out onto 2nd Avenue. I crossed the street so I didn't have to smell the garlic powder. Anyway, I don't use garlic powder, but this dry rub is sensational. Of course, it's Julia Child's. And I have made a sort of a riff on it, meaning I didn't, you know, that she gives you the proportions for 1 pound of pork. We'll get to the pork in a minute. And It's perfect, by the way. I did it I used her exact measurements, with the exception of one little thing, and I'll tell you that in a second, because I didn't have it in the house. And I would say it was exactly right for a 1 1/4 pork tenderloin, one of the cuts that I've been cooking. Pork tenderloin is like the filet mignon of pork. And maybe it costs a little bit more, but it's an extremely lean but tender, and if you cook it correctly, juicy meat. So I've been using that. So this is what I've been doing, because I don't want to make it up every time I cook pork, which has been a lot lately, and I've been using this marinade sèche. My formula is, now this is enough for about 8 pounds of pork, or, you know, pork chops. If you're making pork chops, you've got enough here for at least, I would say 8 pork chops. So that's a lot of pork chops. 3 tablespoons of salt. Oh, this is the moment, I think, Marshall, that I should announce that this little recipe is going to be on the website, the Robin Hood Radio website, as of later today.
Yeah, we're going to start doing that.
We're going to start doing that.
Yeah, whatever.
Putting my little recipes up. And is it going to be on the same page as the actual?
It'll be
broadcast?
On the same. Yeah, on the on-demand page. When they go to it from now on, there'll be a recipe that's included with all the other information. Absolutely.
Good, because I know people. I got an email last week from somebody who said, you know, could you tell me the oven? I got everything but the oven temperature on that recipe, and you know, I since I'm not sure I recorded that recipe, I didn't know myself. So I need to do this for myself as well as everybody else. It's hard to get a recipe off the radio. So here's my formula. 3 tablespoons of salt. We're going to get to salt in a minute, too, an important ingredient in your kitchen. 2 teaspoons of, I use dried sage, which I rub between my palms, or I should say the heel of one hand and the palm of the other, and make it powdery. So add that to the salt. This is, by the way, as I said, eight times the Julia Child recipe. Actually, not exactly. 3 tablespoons of salt, 2 teaspoons of thyme that you rub together. So it's going to actually be a little over 2 teaspoons when you measure it out. A full teaspoon of freshly ground pepper. And these are the 2 ingredients maybe you should go out and buy if you don't have. A whole teaspoon, this is for 8 portions, a whole teaspoon of ground allspice. I use a lot of allspice. I actually buy it in a large container because the Middle Eastern food, Greek food, I don't know, I end up using a lot of allspice. So I always have that in the house. And ground allspice will keep at least a year. And now this is the ingredient nobody has, and I've been looking for, and I can't find. So I had to do it myself. Julia calls for a tiny bit. Well, it ends up in this amount, 2 teaspoons, I'm going to say. I'm sorry, 1 teaspoon of ground bay leaf. Now, I suppose 50 years ago you could find ground bay leaf in the supermarket, but I can't. So I have a lot of bay leaves because I collect bay leaves when I travel to countries that have bay leaf trees, and a lot of them do where I go, certainly all around the Mediterranean. And I discovered in Ireland they use bay laurel as a hedge also. Anyway, I ground up my bay leaves. It happened to be my Irish bay leaves, which are several years old, but bay leaves seem to last a long time, dry bay leaves. Once I ground them up, they were so aromatic. Bob thought they were actually smelled medicinal, but the smell of ground bay is eucalyptus, is the closest. And so I guess you could say that's sort of a medicinal smell. So I'll repeat, and then we'll put it up online. 3 tablespoons of salt, 2 teaspoons of dry thyme, 1 teaspoon of freshly ground black pepper, 1 teaspoon of ground bay leaf, and I'll tell you, and 1 teaspoon of allspice. And you just mix it all up together and sprinkle it lightly over, I would say, a heaping teaspoon of this over for each 1 pound of pork. A heaping teaspoon of this plus a little bit more was enough to salt and season my 1.5 pound pork tenderloin, which I laid out on a piece of saran, plastic wrap, and I sprinkled on all sides with this mixture, and then wrapped it very tightly in the plastic wrap and let it sit in the refrigerator. In this case, it was for a day and a half. I did it one evening, and I didn't make it until lunch 2 days later. So, but you could 2 days, 4 hours. I did pork chops the other day, and I just sprinkled that on maybe 2 hours before I was cooking the chops and let them stay at room temperature, by the way. And they were great. Now, let's do the pork part. Pork is extremely lean these days, and I happened to be in the early 1980s, could have even been in the late 1970s. I was sent to Ames, Iowa, well, Des Moines and Ames, to learn about pork production, because that was the time when the pork producers decided that their problem with pork was that it was too fatty. Americans were becoming very fat conscious, and they needed to lean up their product. And in fact, they called it a breeding and feeding program to make pork leaner. And they did such a good job that I can't eat pork anymore. Because it is just like, you know, cardboard. Has no flavor. You know, if this is, I'm talking about your run-of-the-mill supermarket pork. But even that you can cook to make it okay. I have been buying, I eye my pork. And sometimes I do buy pork chop in the supermarket, as I did the other day, because they looked great. They looked like they had some fat, integral fat. And I prefer rib-end pork chops to center cut. Now, I see at my butcher that and he has them all out in a case in a tray. He must sell much more boneless pork chops than he does bone-in pork chops, because he has many more in the case. That's, people don't want bones, they don't want fat, and I don't even know why they bother. They could eat chicken, and it would be better. So I look for integral fat, but the other day my butcher had, in fact, what he was calling country ribs. Now, they weren't country ribs. They were rib and pork chops. Now, how you know is it'll have a section in the middle that's the white loin meat, but around that will be darker meat, and if it's some part of the rib, there'll even be a little bone that goes into that area. They should have bones still attached, and they will have a little bit more integral fat. In fact, when I make a pork roast, I prefer a rib end pork loin. Now, sometimes I'll see that in a supermarket and I'll buy it, and then I butterfly this rib end pork loin. And when I roll it up with seasoning, usually I do the Tuscan arista, which is garlic, rosemary, and a lot of salt and pepper. And I roll it up, and I roll it with the fat side in so that it gets some basting inside the meat. And then don't overcook it. It's an easy meat to cook, actually, because you don't have to cook it too much. Now, the pork tenderloin, for instance, if I want to do it in my cast iron skillet, it'll take about 15 minutes of it rolling around in the skillet. I do cut it in half so that the thick end of it is one piece and the tapering end of it is another piece, which, of course, will cook quicker. And it takes a while, and you should measure, I have an instant meat thermometer at hand. Once it gets to 145, you've killed everything. I mean, actually, the only thing that people are scared of with pork is trichinosis, which the incidence of trichinosis in the U.S. over the last 40 years has been practically zero. It is, I believe, zero for commercially produced pork. The only cases of trichinosis in the last I just looked this up again this morning because I remember this from 40 years ago when I was the food editor of the Daily News and we covered this, that there was no trichinosis in the U.S. except home-raised pork, which are not cared for, not husbanded, as well as commercial pork. And there are some breeds now. Old Gloucester is one. Berkshire pork is another. These are old, you might say, heirloom breeds from England that are now being bred here that have not been subjected to the breeding and feeding program that has made American pork so lean that you don't want to eat it. So make sure that your pork has some fat on it. So for succulents, and I must say, when we watch these barbecue shows, you can see they're all about cooking low and slow, and that is in many cases the best thing for pork is low and slow, even when it's a pork chop. So you can do something called the reverse sear, and you could do this with a pork tenderloin as well, and that means cook it in a low heat oven. 250, 275, no more than 300 degrees, and depending on the thickness of the piece of meat, it should be at least 100, and I would say you want to take it out of the oven at 140 degrees, which is not cooked through quite yet, and then, or even 135, for that matter, and then you let it rest a little bit, because one, you want the juices to retreat into the meat, but two, which have come to the surface, but two, you're going to now subject it to very high heat, and you don't want to overcook the meat. So if you let it sit for 15 minutes, once you put it over high heat to give it a nice brown exterior, you won't be taking the meat above, I hope, not above 155, which is just pink in the middle, and that's nice. It should be nice and juicy. If you can eat pork even rarer than that safely. You know, 150 is fine. Even 145, you killed everything if there was anything to begin with, which there isn't. So just don't overcook your pork, no matter. And I don't know, but in the New York Times, I read food stuff all the time. A lot of recipes for thin-cut pork chops. I'm not sure how you make those delicious. I look for very thick-cut pork chops, which is, by the way, my supermarket that I was shopping in the other day, one of the several, the pork was these beautiful, beautiful rib-end pork chops, an inch and a half thick, were only $1.99 a pound. I mean, there are vegetables that cost more than $1.99 a pound. So it's a very value meat, high-value meat, and just don't overcook it, and salt. So now we've got to get to the salt part. I just read the most ridiculous story. I always say the only misinformation I get on my social media feeds is the wrong oven temperature or pan size. But the other day I read something that came through on Facebook about the differences between diamond crystal kosher salt and I forget even what the other one is called. But kosher salt has become a thing. Mainly, it seems to me, because chefs like to feel things, I guess. I don't know. But they're always talking about how that, you know, feeling the coarse salt. Well, you can feel fine salt, too, let me tell you. And two, the fact is, yes, diamond crystal is different than the other brand, which I'm not remembering. But what about taste? Didn't anybody ever teach you to taste while you're cooking? Salt is certainly one of those things that you need to taste for. And also, salt is very variable, not only by your physiology, but by your taste. I know people who say they cook without salt, and I say to myself, I wouldn't say to them, I don't want to eat in your house, because salt is an essential I think, in food. And by the way, people who don't eat salt don't, you know, usually people are told not to eat salt because they have high blood pressure. And just to say, most of those people still have high blood pressure even though they're on low-salt diets. So according to my cardiological consultants, you need to be on medication if you have high blood pressure and don't depend only on low salt. Now, of course, everybody can reduce their salt, but you need a little salt. Now, yes, Diamond Crystal has a different crystal size than the other kosher salt, and there's apparently a significant difference in sodium from one to the other. But I don't use kosher salt, so I'm not sort of conscious of all that. Kosher, by the way, is not kosher. It's used to kosher, as we say, meat and poultry, which is to say, if you're kosher, you need to draw juices out from those products. And I don't want to get into all that stuff, but and the large crystals of salt tend to stay on the surface and not penetrate as much and make it salty, make the food salty. I use sea salt myself, and I use a particular sea salt from the province of Trapani in Sicily, which is famous for its sea salt. I've been to the salt beds in Marsala, the same place that the wine is from, the extensive salt beds. And it's salt that is, there are different ways of harvesting it, but it is very pure from Mediterranean Sea salt. And yes, I can tell the difference. Nowadays, after using it for 30 years, I must say 30 years ago, if I wasn't in Sicily myself to buy some, or I should say in Italy, because they sell it all over Italy, I would have my friend Francesco, who went back and forth. He would bring me bags. They're 1 kilo, 2.2 pound bags of both fine and coarse Trapani sea salt. When Francesco passed away and we cleaned out his apartment, I can't tell you how many pounds. I mean, there was a pantry full of Sicilian sea salt, which I inherited. And so it was years before I needed to buy any. But nowadays, I buy it all the time. Now, do not buy it in a fancy jar in a gourmet shop. You will pay for the jar and the shop more than the salt. I buy it at my butcher, and I think it's like maybe $2.39 for a kilo box of it, which lasts quite a long, 2.2 pounds lasts quite a long time. I keep the coarse salt around. If I'm making something with liquid in it, I'm salting the water for pasta. I use the coarse salt, and I do measure it. I don't just use my fingers, although I do that too. And the fine salt is for everything else. I even put it in the salt shaker. Now, the salt from Trapani is salty salt. I know this because it's my regular salt. So I sort of know where to start with salt, and then, of course, as I'm cooking, I taste, and we add a little more salt, and when I was a little boy, I always say I was born with a wooden spoon in my mouth, because when I was a little boy, my grandmother would give me tastes of whatever she was making and say, enough salt, enough pepper. I mean, like a five-year-old, I was allowed to give my opinion about salt and pepper. But, you know, it's true. You have to keep tasting. And things change, too. For instance, if you're going to cook something and make it and then eat it cold or at room temperature, you probably need a little bit more salt than if you're eating it hot. And, you know, you got to know your salt. There's an old expression, know your onions. I'm telling you, know your salt, no matter what salt you use. And there are a zillion different salts out there these days. I just went into my little spice cabinet here and shelves that I keep all this stuff. I have 9 different kinds of salt in my house at this moment. Himalayan sea salt, which is that pink salt you see all over the place. Yeah. My friend Suzanne swears by it, and I got to ask her today why she swears by it, but other than it's pink, I know she likes pink. Then there's also Hawaiian sea salt, which is ocean salt, truly. It's pink. I have salt from a lake in Colima, Mexico, where they also evaporate the water for salt. It's a wet salt and probably the perfect salt to rim a glass for a margarita. I've kept that more as a souvenir. I've used it, but I'm sort of hoarding it because I like the idea of it. Let's see. I have my Trapani salt in both coarse and fine grain. I have kosher salt. I'm not sure which one, but it's in a box here in the kitchen. A lot of different salt. And you got to know which is which because, and by the way, there are some salts that have no iodine. If you're one of those people who needs iodine, and sort of everybody needs some iodine, and you don't have other sources of iodine, then you probably want to buy an iodized salt or a salt that is high in iodine. On most mineral salt boxes, it will tell you, I mean, sea salt boxes, it will tell you what the mineral contents are. And you might even want to consult your physician about that. For instance, I know that I am a little high in potassium because of how I eat, which is a lot of dark green leaves and avocados and all that is high in potassium. I don't even eat bananas or potatoes, and those are high potassium foods, but I don't eat them. But still, I'm getting, according to my doctor, plenty of potassium, and maybe I should cut down on the avocado. That's okay with me. I'm not, avocados, I don't know. They're too California for me, probably.
Well, they're meant to be very healthy. There was just a report out on them, though.
No, avocados are very healthy, which is why I eat them. And also, I do like avocados, you know. There was a very funny, I think it was a cartoon in the New Yorker just a few weeks ago about, you know, to the effect that one day it's hard and the next day it's overripe. So as hard as I try to get the avocado right, I don't always. the other thing that I always try, that I have been striking, I must say, cantaloupe has been sensational. And even when I pick one that I think is marginal, it's been great. So I think this is the end of the more or less local, more or less than more, cantaloupe season. And also peppers, the end of the red peppers season. I bought a lot of red peppers at the farmer's market the other day only because I thought, well, this may never be again, and we'll see. You know, it's 40-something up there now?
It was 39 this morning.
Well, there you go. You can give it another week, and then we could have a hard freeze.
I hope not.
Well, I don't know. Why not? I could use a chill myself.
So when you folks look for Arthur on the on-demand page, remember, we're going to include recipes.
Yes, I'm going to include this little recipe. Let's call it Marinade Sèche, only because I love saying it.
Okay.
Right. Yeah, I'm going to send that to you, and we need to remind people that I'm at the...
I think we should, yeah.
The Sheffield Library on November 6th.
And it's only about 30, 35 people, so...
people.
Yeah, so make your reservation at the library.
So you have to... Excuse me. You have to reserve.
All right.
And I don't have the number in front of me, do you have it in front of you?
No, but what I'll do is I'll also put it
here
up
it
on
is,
the...
Here it is. I got it. 413-229-7004. It's the Saturday afternoon at 2 o'clock. Informal chat with me. I understand somebody's baking cookies. If you want to bring food to share, I guess it's 2 o'clock. That's good.
Why not? That's right. A midday break.
No, I'm not asking for food handouts. Believe me.
Right.
No, it's just going to be a nice informal chat, questions and answers, not just me talking, and 2 o'clock at the Bushnell Library.
All right, Arthur.
Thank you. Have a good week, everyone.
Yep, take care. Arthur Schwartz, the food maven, here on Robin Hood Radio, the Robin Hood Radio Network.
Underwriting support for Arthur Schwartz, the food maven, John Andrews Restaurant on the Hillsdale Road in South Egremont, 413-528-3467, and on the web, jarestaurant.com. Rubiner's Cheesemongers and Grocers on Main Street in Great Barrington, 413-528-0488, rubiners.com. Hillsdale Home Chef, more information, 518-325-7000, hgshomechef.com.